Well, welcome to the Skin of Color Savvy, the art and science of treating patients of color, the official podcast of the Skin of Color Society. Produced by HCP Live and hosted by SOX leaders, Skin of Color Savvy delves into the latest research, clinical insights, and culturally intelligent and responsive care practices in dermatology with leading experts. So we are here with Dr. Michelle Rodriguez, who has been the chair of the Skin of Color Society's presentation here at the EADV conference in Paris, France. And we are here on site right now. And Dr. Rodriguez, if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about your position.
Thank you, Tim. I'm Michelle Rodriguez, dermatologist from Melbourne, Australia, and I hold some academic positions at the Royal Children's Hospital and a non-for-profit skin health institute. And I'm also the founder and director of Chromodermatology, which is Australia's first and only dedicated centre for pigmentary disorders and dermatology in skin of colour. And I'm associate professor at the University of Melbourne.
Excellent. Well, thanks for sharing that. And we really appreciate your being here at EADV. Of course, it's not the worst city to be in, Paris, France. I feel like we're doing okay being here, right?
Well, absolutely, absolutely. Aside from the strikes, which is why we're having to do this in this way, it's an incredible city, so much to see and do, and of course, so much to learn at this EADV.
Yes. Well, I wanted to ask you first and foremost about some stuff that you presented here at EADV on behalf of Skin of Color Society. I know that there was a specific presentation entitled Unmasking Facial Hyperpigmentation in Richly Pigmented Skin Types. And I know that you touched on a lot of important stuff in that talk. So could you just tell us a little bit about what you did highlight during that discussion?
Look, I think it's such an important topic, Tim, and I was deeply grateful to, be able to represent the Skin of Colour Society at this inaugural symposium. And really, the crux of what I said at the symposium was that disorders of hyperpigmentation are very vast, and there are over 45 causes of facial hyperpigmentation alone. Differentiating them can sometimes be easy, but there are a group of conditions, melasma, acquired dermal macular hyperpigmentation, ochronosis, and post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation that can really be tough to differentiate, even for the most astute clinician. So this is really the crux of what I discussed at the symposium.
And I wanted to ask you then, in light of that discussion, what would you say are some of the biggest challenges in diagnosing facial hyperpigmentation in patients, like you said, with richly pigmented skin? And how can clinicians sort of avoid common pitfalls there?
Well, first of all, the most important thing is to understand that hyperpigmentation in the epidermis and dermis can look different morphologically and from a colour perspective. And so I like to use melasma as my compass, as my due north, from which I can then differentiate other causes of hyperpigmentation. So one of the key takeaways was that with melasma, it does not involve the eyelids and it does not involve the earlobes and it does not involve extra facial sites, as opposed to, say, post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, acquired dermal macular hyperpigmentation. These sorts of things can involve sites other than the face. The second pitfall is that most people fall into a trap of believing the patient, of course, and saying, okay, they've come in, they're telling me they have a diagnosis of melasma and just running with it without really looking more closely. And one of the things that we can do other than a macroscopic review of the skin is to actually take out a dermatoscope and hold the dermatoscope on the skin, because that dermatoscope gives us very quick, non-invasive information that can help guide the differential diagnosis. And one of the main features of post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation and acquired dermal macular hyperpigmentation, as opposed to melasma, is that you'll see this peppering across the dermoscopic slide that you see, or across the dermoscopic image that you see through your dermatoscope. And that is one of the key features. Of course, there are others, hem-like structures, dots and globules, and so forth, that can also help to define lichenoid dermatoses and acquired dermal macular hyperpigmentation. And of course, if you're seeing onchronosis, which is the condition that is caused by excessive chronic ongoing use of hydroquinone, you can also see blue-gray amorphous areas, white dots, obliteration of eccrine ducts and structures. So the dermoscopy piece is very, very important for those who are serious about differentiating the different causes of hyperpigmentation. And as you alluded to, one of the biggest challenges is the diagnosis, because the management is very, very different. So if we don't get the diagnosis right, we are potentially, as clinicians, taking patient on a very long and complicated, sometimes expensive journey on treatments that are actually not appropriate for the person. So diagnosis first, treatment next.
Some very good points. Thanks for sharing those. Okay, and then would you say there are key clinical or dermoscopic features, I'm sorry, that help distinguish between some of these signs in patients of color specifically?
Well, definitely in richly pigmented skin, you'll see a diffuse accentuation of the hyperpigmentation. You'll see sparing of the eccrine follicles. You potentially see arcuate structures. With acquired dermal macular hyperpigmentation, you see those dots, globules, peppering, and hem-like structures. And in post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, definitely the peppering as well. In patients who have post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, however, you can also get a little bit of information from the patient themselves. They might say, I've had a previous itch, scale, or rash. And of course, you can always do a full, complete clinical examination to determine whether or not there's any coexisting primary dermatoses, and that will help define whether or not it's PIH in addition to the dermoscopic features. And also, we're thinking about onchronosis, asking the patient about long-term history, use of hydroquinone, and so forth. And as I said, the white dots, amorphous areas, and obliteration of equine structures and so forth is an important factor to consider. The other in richly pigmented skin is the subtle changes in color. So melasma is always shades of brown, whereas acquired dermal macular hyperpigmentation is often ashy, bluish, or grayish in hue rather than shades of brown. And when we look at onchronosis, again, often violaceous, erythematous hues coming through, or a history of change in the color of the hyperpigmentation affecting the face.
And how does facial hyperpigmentation, just in your experience and from what you've observed, uniquely impact a quality of life, self-image, mental health in patients with richly pigmented skin, maybe compared to patients with lighter skin types or just in general?
Well, I'm so glad that you bring this up, Tim, because globally, irrespective of skin type, disorders of hyperpigmentation affecting the face significantly impact quality of life. And there's been extensive documentation of depression, anxiety, isolation, and more importantly, not just quality of life, but stigmatization. So patients often feel as if they're being excluded, they're not as loved. And in fact, this has been shown in a very, very large study undertaken by L'Oréal. Of over 48,000 participants in over 32 countries, a significant impact of quality of life. And what's more important is not only do 50% of the global population get affected by hyperpigmentation, of those 50%, nearly a third of them have more than one disorder affecting the face. So this is quite significant. Of course, patients with more richly pigmented skin often have troubles, A, getting the correct diagnosis. B, being adequately assessed in terms of the severity of the diagnosis. And number three, there are certain nuances to treatment that can affect not only the outcomes, but also the patient journey along the way. And I'll give you an example of that. So, for example, melasma, one of the most common causes of facial hyperpigmentation. Oftentimes, we're using combinations of tyrosinase inhibitors such as hydroquinone combined with retinoids or vitamin A derivatives. Now, these retinoids can be well tolerated in lighter skin types, but in certain intermediate skin types can cause significant dermatitis, erythema, and so forth that can actually cause post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation and make the facial hyperpigmentation even worse. And of course, chemical peels, laser and energy-based devices also have a narrow margin of error in darkly pigmented skin and therefore can cause or exacerbate the hyperpigmentation and cause post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. So for those that have richly pigmented skin, not only can the diagnosis and severity be affected, but also the treatment journey and what they experience during that treatment journey could be very unique. And at one other point, when we're dealing with patients that have lighter skin type with facial hyperpigmentation, it's often appropriate to say, look, we're going to treat this and it's going to be about 3 to 4 month journey. During this time, if you can use a tinted foundation, try to cosmetically camouflage, you can get through this period. And oftentimes, patients are quite amenable to that. They don't mind using tinted sunscreens, popping on their foundation, and trying to mask that. But you can imagine someone who has richly pigmented skin, who then has hyperpigmentation, is often not wanting to be multiple shades darker in order to cover this. And furthermore, oftentimes you can't even find the right agents to actually make this happen, even if they were agreeable. So, multiple factors there that are subtly different, but I can tell you that the stigmatization and quality of life impact is universal across the board when it comes to facial hyperpigmentation.
I wanted to ask about something that you touched on a little bit there, which was treatment considerations. And what treatment strategies would you say are most effective and safe for hyperpigmentation in richly pigmented skin? And are there therapies clinicians should be particularly cautious about due to worsening risks of hyperpigmentation and that kind of thing?
Look, the most important thing for those with richly pigmented skin is to ensure that photoprotection is foundational. And I don't just mean looking for an SPF factor of 30 plus in a sunscreen or 50 plus in a sunscreen. I'm actually talking about looking at ultraviolet light A, ultraviolet light A1, so long wave UVA, and visible light protection, which means looking at specific sunscreens that have the right filters and that are tinted to the correct level, in order to provide protection against worsening and, of course, actually improving the condition itself. Secondly, we can use topical antioxidant agents, very, very mild and gentle on the skin, vitamin E and C combination. Also, vitamin B or niacinamide is a nice, gentle agent that can be utilized in richly pigmented skin without irritation in most instances. And I think it's important with the new and emerging treatments that we have that are non-hydroquinone based. So things like 2-MNG, thimerosal are some examples of these agents that we can and should really be utilizing given the emerging evidence for their both efficacy and safety in darker skin types. I will say that hydroquinone in as monotherapy, but in particular combination therapy, remains the current gold standard for treatment. But I think that it's important to tweak the concentration of retinoids and certainly monitor the patient very closely if they have richly pigmented skin to ensure they're not developing retinoid dermatitis. And then, of course, there are other modalities that are equally efficacious and safe across different cultural groups and skin types, oral vasomodulators like tranexamic acid, in addition to oral antioxidants, are very helpful. And adjunctive therapies like chemical peels and laser and energy-based devices can be utilized, but with lasers, lowering the fluence, reducing erythema as an endpoint, and with chemical peels going very light, going very superficial, and in both instances, doing test patches first to ensure that there are no adverse reactions in darker skin types.
And are there any newer treatments or technologies, research findings that you would say hold promise for improving outcomes in hyperpigmentation for these patient populations?
Certainly, there are some new and emerging, as I said, non-hydroquinone-based agents. And the reason that these are key and important to understand is that we don't have to tell the patients to stop using them. There's no risk of onchronosis in the long term. And so when you've got a chronic and relapsing condition that requires treatment over prolonged periods of time, being able to provide agents that you don't have to stop is, of course, an important point for many patients. The other one is oral antioxidants. And we've seen a lot of good evidence for this in the past, but there's more and more evidence to suggest that as an adjunct to the treatment of melasma in particular, that can be very helpful. With acquired dermal macular hyperpigmentation, I highlighted this in the presentation, a publication just posted last week in the PMCR. In our center in Australia was involved, but it was a multi-center trial over six sites, actually looked at low-dose oral isotretinoin as a helpful agent for both halting of the progression of acquired dermal macular hyperpigmentation and reducing the hyperpigmentation itself.
Just kind of looking back here at your talk, what practical take-home tips then would you share with clinicians who maybe want to be more effective and culturally sensitive, when it comes to managing facial hyperpigmentation?
Well, I think in remembering the distribution of the common disorders of hyperpigmentation, number one. Number two, the color and the hues that you're seeing on richly pigmented skin give excellent clues to the diagnosis. Number three, make sure you've got your dermatoscope right by you all the time and start placing it on the patient's skin so that you get to know and see the different patterns that you will then be able to recognize as a non-invasive tool to help differentiate disorders of hyperpigmentation. The other important point I think that was a take-home message really was that photoprotection, a 360 approach, not just UVB, but UVA, UVA1, and visible light protection in richly pigmented skin is critical for the prevention and the management of disorders of hyperpigmentation. And finally, I think for me, the Skin of Colour Society has been an incredible source of support, of friendships, and of ability to really connect and collaborate to really bring to the forefront all the important aspects of skin of color dermatology. And I think the collaborative efforts of the Skin of Color Society really can help elevate our patient care, and the delivery of outcomes for patients with richly pigmented skin. So for those that are seeking mentors or more learning opportunities, I highly recommend the Skin of Color Society as a starting point.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Rodriguez. That was a great discussion. We really appreciate you taking the time here. It was just a generally very engaging and insightful conversation. But yeah, this does wrap up this episode of Skin of Color Savvy. Thank you all, everyone listening, for your time. Thank you, Dr. Rodriguez, for your time as well. And we hope everyone today found this discussion informative and inspiring. If you're interested in learning more about the Skin of Color Society and its impactful work, I do encourage you to visit the skinofcolorsociety.org. And please don't forget to subscribe to HCP Live's newsletters and follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest in dermatology and more. And we'll be back soon with another episode. So be sure to subscribe to Skin of Color Savvy on your favorite podcast platforms. And until next time, thanks so much and thank you for listening.